welcome to Chatting with Ingram. I'm Philip Ingram, and today I'm talking to John Kameh again, who's a QC with 36 Crime. We're talking terrorism, terrorist financing, serious organised crime, and a lot more. Warning, you might actually learn something. So today again, I'm very fortunate to be able to welcome to the Chatting with Ingram, John Kameh, who is a QC with 36 Crime. Now, we're going to be talking around, terrorist financing or organised crime financing and the sorts of things that could potentially be done about it. But John, good to have you back on Chatting with Ingram again.
Good to see you again, Philip. Nice to be here.
Yes, you're still surviving lockdown.
Yeah, I'm pretty busy, actually. God knows when they're going to come in, but there's a lot of cases hanging around at the moment, all of which have got documents to be drafted and hearings to be attended over Zoom. Yeah, lockdown is sadly becoming a bit boring, to be honest. I'd like to be out there properly.
Yes, it would be good. Mind you, we are seeing the law enforcement agencies out there. There was a fantastic result by the NCA published yesterday with Operation Venetec, where they managed to take down an awful lot of serious and organised criminals from around the UK.
Well, yeah, the NCA haven't had a particularly good time of it, PR-wise, over the last few months. We might come on to that later, I think.
I think we probably will.
Yeah. No, covered themselves in glory yesterday. I mean, some say it was the French that cracked the code for these Encron mobile phones that are used by organised crime.
But yeah, it was Encrochat, which is interesting. I'll give a bit of an overview of that in a sec, but go on.
Well, I mean, as far as if you read the news, at least, is concerned, what happened yesterday was, I think in this country alone, 746 arrests, 77 weapons, £54 million in cash recovered.
Yeah.
As a result of this series of raids, which I think actually started in the middle of June, rolling up this Encro chat network, not only I think scoring a massive blow against organised crime in this country, but we've heard of arrests in Holland, Spain, Sweden. But of course, the knock-on effect is it's going to be like a domino effect. It depends on the will of other countries, but this could be something that reverberates around the world, because with the interconnectedness of organised crime, terrorist financing, etc. these days, this could lead a long, long way.
Yeah, and amongst that, I understand there was 2 tons of drugs as well, and it shows the power of multinational and international operations in taking down crime, and it also shows the multinational aspect of how the criminals are beginning to operate, because the Encrochat communications network, it was quite strange. It was a bespoke mobile phone type device that had this software on it. And the software could be hidden in a way that it wasn't obvious, and it just looked as if it was a normal telephone. But you logged into it. But the fact that you needed this special piece of hardware, and this is where they failed. Theoretically, it's brilliant. You pay a lot of money, you get this specially encrypted device that only if you've got one of these devices with this Eurochat communications software on it, can you communicate with someone else, and encryption can't be broken and all the rest of it. However, by the very fact that these devices were being put out there, that will have put a red flag up to all of the different intelligence agencies, and they'll have gone and bought them because they're commercially available, and they'll have then put their effort into finding a way of breaking the encryption or breaking into the system. And I understand what they did was they put a bit of malware out that compromised the network for a short period of time, but that was enough time for them to download at least 50% of the customers or the users' details. And then once they got all the users' details, they then just used normal legislation to go and sit and listen in and build up their cases on everyone else. But they could see what people had been saying to each other, including some of the comments saying, we're in trouble here if the NCA have got hold of this, and various other things.
There was also, I don't know if this is true or not, but I read that Encrochat themselves messaged about 60,000 users back in the middle of June, so about 3 or 4 weeks ago, warning them to throw their devices, their 1,000 euro devices away, because their servers had been seized illegally by government entities. And I wonder how those in charge of Encrochat going to react when they themselves might get nicked by the police?
Well, I think they're based in the Netherlands, and I think the Dutch police have already been along and tapped on the door and said, excuse me, can we have a little chat, please? The frightening thing is, and this is where the terrorists have learned a little bit more, however, there were some Irish terrorist-related individuals who had used this. But if they'd actually used some of the normal encrypted, end-to-end encrypted bits of software that are available just to be able to download and use them in the same sort of way, that have hidden among so much noise.
Yeah.
The issue is that, and the message is getting out there quite well, that the Europol had cracked a lot of the so-called Islamic State end-to-end encrypted groups on WhatsApp and closed most of their encryption channels down on there. But then the Islamic State and Al-Qaeda, who were using it, executed sort of 5 days before that happened, a perfect business continuity plan, and moved on to three other networks, which haven't been broken by the intelligence services yet. But it shows that there's this constant cat and mouse game going on between the intelligence services technically and terrorists and as we've seen here, serious and organised criminals.
I tell you what, though, it's not necessarily the end of the story so far as law enforcement is concerned, because defense lawyers are going to have a field day with this. It all depends as to whether or not this qualifies as an intercept as defined under the Investigatory Powers Act, because if certain requirements and authorities haven't been satisfied and obtained by the police, and I guess the NCA aren't stupid, I'm sure they would have covered anything in advance, but it will still, I think, be a fertile ground for defence lawyers to argue that this evidence has been obtained unfairly or unlawfully. There'll be arguments, no doubt, about right to privacy under the Human Rights Convention, etc., etc. It'll be interesting to see just how much of this evidence is admissible before a jury.
Yeah.
So this story isn't over, but I mean, let's face it, in terms of cracking crime and recovering criminal assets, this is a major blow and a good day for the
And as they start interviewing them, it'll start to close further networks down. And
The intelligence fallout from this is going to be huge, isn't it? You know about that.
Exactly. And people at this level, you're going to get some of them are not going to say anything. You're going to get others that are going to sing like canaries because they want to try and do a deal. But for any of the criminals that are listening out there, or their defense barristers that might listen into this, I presume the amount of money they've got, they'll be having silks, not just straight barristers trying to defend them. Having worked closely with the intelligence agencies, even overseas, there was one particular operational theatre that I was in, and we had the ability to target the communications equipment of an individual that was passing through our area, and we knew that he was a very, very, very bad man and very high up. And even stuck in another country around the world, and I had a GCHQ rep with me there, we had to get the warrants put back through GCHQ, back through the GCHQ lawyers. It had to be signed off at ministerial level for this potential intercept to happen before we could actually carry out the technical attack that we could have done. And unfortunately, we didn't get the warrant signed, so it didn't happen, even though we had the ways and means there and then to do it. Yeah. And being in a weird country, nobody would have known anything different. But it's the one thing that I can put out there to anyone that's listening, is that the intelligence agencies actually now do recognise the importance of making sure that the legal warrants, the I's are dotted, the T's are crossed before they do anything, because they know that this could end up in court. And this is a clear example of a national level intelligence agency supporting the national effort against criminal activity. It's not all about trying to crack spies, military and everything else. So fascinating result, absolutely fascinating result.
What's your take on the, was it 24 arrests from the PSNI in Northern Ireland yesterday, and claiming to have mitigated, I think, 15 threats to life? What do you think lays behind all of that?
Oh, almost 100% that's related to dissident republicanism. And the thing about dissident republicanism in Northern Ireland and on the island of Ireland is that they wear two hats. They've got their terrorist hats that they'll wear on a, you know, an evening in the weekend, and they want a united Ireland. They want to fly the terrorist flag, and they want to play that play this cause. But the reality is, their Monday to Friday job is they're serious and organised criminals at the highest level. You know, the real IRA, which is a component of the new IRA, was listed by Forbes Israel magazine in 2014 as being the ninth richest terrorist organisation in the globe, with an annual turnover of about 38 million quid. They get all that money through extortion, through drug running, through people smuggling, through cattle smuggling, through red diesel filtering, and all the usual activities that you'd see any mafia type organization doing. And they run themselves very much like mafia type organizations. It's based on your wider family groupings and loyalties amongst those family groupings that enables them to do what they do. Where there's a link between money that's coming through serious and organized crime and money that is related to terrorism, because it's the same money that's used for both.
So when I successfully defended a really likable guy who I think was from County Tyrone, this is going back about 15 years now. He had an articulated truck full of cigarettes, which, as I recall, did come from the Balkans. And he came through a very well-known truck stop in a place called Vern, just inside the Belgian border from France, and was intercepted in Dover with this massive consignment, you know, fraudulent evasion of the tax duty on cigarettes. Mm-hmm. Do you think it's likely then that he was, well, what do you think he was up to?
Well, I think it's more than that. I think it's more than likely that he was, especially if he's coming from Tyrone, that he will have been taking that into terrorist organizations so that they could sell it out around the local communities and raise money through this serious and organized criminal behavior, but raise money for the terrorist organizations. And coming up through the Balkans, it's interesting. I've actually spent an awful lot of time in the Balkans and spent time with different groups and organizations where we've been investigating them and knowing full well that they are the primary fake cigarette smugglers into the rest of Europe, as well as people smugglers, primarily for sex trafficking. But also there was one investigation I was helping with the Institute of Migration, the United Nations Institute of Migration, where they were looking at smuggling people for body parts, which was quite horrific. And you know, the crime that was coming up through is all linked the whole way through. And at the end of the day, the people who are supplying the fake goods don't care whether those fake goods are going to fund terrorism or they're going to fund other criminal activity. They just want the money. It's all about money.
And the same goes perhaps, well, one can only speculate, for the Purfleet disaster.
Yeah. Again, you know, it's interesting that there's the Ireland link in it. And there's traditionally been quite a bit of serious and organized crime around Ireland, but it's not that big a market for these serious and organized criminals. The people that control it, that have controlled it for a large number of years, are the ones that are controlling the terror organizations. So they're the ones that are doing the high end, the big level smuggling. And of course, these routes that they use to bring in people or to bring in fake cigarettes or to bring in fake booze and all the rest of it are the same routes that they use to bring in weapons and explosives and everything else. So it's all linked.
So I was saying that it's a good day for the NCA yesterday, but they had a very bad day back in...
Yeah, what happened then? I said, you know, I saw that the NCA had got something wrong with regard to, was it an unexplained wealth order that they had been using as a tool? What is that as a tool? What did they do? What did they do wrong? And you know, how successful are they generally?
Well, that's exactly what it is. It's a tool. It is not a catch-all magic wand to estreat dishonest or rather the proceeds of crime or goods suspected to be the proceeds of crime from individuals. It is a tool primarily designed to gain information. And It really came in the wake of there's a great difficulty, or there was traditionally a great difficulty attached to the Proceeds of Crime Act, which is that civil recovery of goods suspected to be the proceeds of crime always been very, very difficult, particularly when you deal with organised crime that sort of transcends borders. So you're having to rely on the cooperation of governments, and governments can change from day to day and they cease to become as accommodating. They may not have particularly willing or well-resourced law enforcement agencies. So, you know, particularly in the areas of international organized crime, confiscation of money and materials was traditionally very, very difficult. And traditionally, of course, under POCA, the Proceeds of Crime Act, you needed convictions and you needed proof that the property concerned was the product of crime. Mm-hmm. So there was a sense of a losing battle. And I think it was David Cameron, it was taken on by Theresa May, and eventually it materialised in the form of the Criminal Finances Act of 2017, which amended the previous legislation to allow for these things called unexplained wealth orders. And these are orders that can be applied for at the High Court by any number of authorities. Primarily, it's the NCA, but you've got also got the CPS, the Financial Conduct Authority, the SFO, the Magisters Revenue and Customs. And what it allows is for the authority to apply for an explanation into the provenance, essentially, of unexplained wealth. And the beauty of this, as far as law enforcement is concerned, is that it doesn't require a conviction and it doesn't require proof that it's dodgy goods. All it needs is to show that the respondent holds the property, that the property is worth more than £50,000, that the property isn't really consistent with the lawful earning capacity of the individual, and that that individual is suspected to be involved in serious crime or is what is known as a politically exposed person. PEP is somebody outside the European Economic Area who is sort of attached to government. I won't go through the full definition. But it allows the authorities to put these people on point and say, you give us an explanation. If you fail to give it, we're going to have the property. Now, in the first two, because there's only been three, the first one you might have heard of, Philip, it's a lady called Zamira Hajieva. She was the one who ran up, was it 16 million at Harrods?
Harrods, yes, the Harrods shopper, yes.
Yeah, she did really well with Harrods. Now, either a husband or a former husband was, I think he was boss of the National Bank of Azerbaijan or something like that. They took her property, they took her mansions, they had it all, because she didn't give a satisfactory explanation. And then there was another one earlier this year, where again, the NCA got with it what they wanted. But in this case of Baker, which came before the High Court back in April, it surrounded the ex-wife and son of a very interesting man called Rakat Aliyev. He was a Kazakhstani chap who died in 2015, suspected committed suicide, who used to be a very big man in Kazakhstan indeed. He was, I think, the deputy director of the KNB, that's the successor to the KGB in Kazakhstan. He was head of the tax police. He was an ambassador to Austria. And he was also implicated in two or three grisly murders and allegedly ran a massive racketeering campaign in the banking, oil refining, news media, telecoms industries. Allegedly all of it ill-gotten gains. Mm-hmm. He gets divorced. He runs off to Malta, I think. He's finally arrested, imprisoned in Austria. And his former wife comes to live in this country and she brings a mass of property with her, mansions, money, etc., as does her son. And unfortunately, the NCA did not cover themselves in glory because they took out this, they made this application. And tactically, the respondents did a clever thing. They provided an explanation. Mm-hmm. Nobody expected that. And it was if you read the judgment, it's an extremely cogent, lengthy financial trail in relation to various properties, which at the end of the day, the NCA just could not defeat. And the judge was particularly scathing because she said that the source of this wealth is no longer unexplained. The NCA's case was flawed by inadequate investigation in a very scathing way. She explained why. So what this has done, I think, is it's rather dented the NCA's credibility in this area because it's shown that maybe they were somewhat complacent in this case. But ultimately, it's shown that you can waste an awful lot of public money because these things cost a fortune. And if the respondent fights it, the bill is going to be astronomical. And so the very financial feasibility of these proceedings suddenly becomes as big an issue as the proceedings themselves. Mm-hmm. So not a good time, and they need to sort that out.
And do you put this down to the fact that there just hadn't been sufficient work done to identify whether there was a perfectly legitimate explanation to where the money had come from? So it's down to individual failings rather than the order itself or the NCA as an organisation itself. It's very easy to blame an organisation, but it's if you've got individuals that are senior investigating officers or you've got senior legal advisors that are in there, if they suffer a groupthink, especially from an arrogant perspective, then that can always lead to this sort of mistake.
Well, I think a lot of people had to look at themselves very carefully in the mirror after that, because, as I said, the judge was absolutely scathing about the flawed and inadequate investigation, failing to investigate what she referred to as obvious lines of inquiry, failing to, in her words, carry out a fair-minded evaluation. The reasons for that, who knows? Was it negligence, carelessness? Was it arrogance, complacency? And I'll tell you, the most interesting finding or observation that she made was that just because an individual or a corporate entity might employ corporate vehicles or offshore structures, in this case, a lot of the funds were registered, I think, in Curaçao and Panama, does not necessarily mean or does not necessarily give rise to a suspicion that those arrangements have not been set up for honest purposes.
Yeah. Now, this is going to get more interesting when we start talking about money sitting in cryptocurrencies and things. There is another unexplained wealth order case where the NCA actually had some success in it, but that went through the Northern Ireland courts, and that was July last year, where there was a Northern Irish woman with suspected links into serious and organised crime associated with paramilitary activity and cigarette smuggling. Goes back to your truck. Couldn't explain where she got sort of £3.2 million worth of six properties across the country, and the NCA managed to get an unexplained wealth order through the High Court quite successfully, and then interim freezing orders stopping the properties being sold and all the rest of it. I don't know where the case has got to yet, but it shows that it's a tool that they are more than happy to use.
I think it's a very useful tool. I mean, if nothing else, in this case of Baker, the one I've just talked about, at the very least, the NCA gleaned an awful lot of information into a money trail. It just so happened in that case, the judge didn't think that the money trail was nefarious. But I think what they needed, or hopefully what they've taken away from it, is that, yeah, it's all right on the one hand to have this rather draconian measure whereby you can impose an order where an explanation hasn't been given in the absence of any sort of conviction. But on the other hand, where an explanation is given, as was given very cogently in this case, as an investigating authority, you are under a duty to investigate it properly. And you must not make assumptions based on whether or not a company is registered in Panama or is got a very sort of complex corporate vehicle or offshore structure behind it.
Yeah.
You've got to actually show, if someone does venture an explanation, you've got to show that explanation is bogus. Otherwise, you will lose. And the point that I made about the cost of this is not insignificant, because, as we all know, public funding has been drastically cut here. And that applies to investigatory bodies within the NCA as much as it does anywhere else. Mm. And going forward, I know it's been suggested that one way around that would be for some sort of public-private funding or partnership in order to pay for these far-flung investigations. And that might become important because, of course, you're dealing with oligarchs, you're dealing with the mega-rich. Paying for lawyers and high court fees is nothing to them. And unless these public bodies are properly funded in order that they can combat or get to the bottom of what may yet turn out to be dishonest explanations and money trials, then, as I said, they're not actually going to get anywhere. So big lessons to be learned. And the ultimate lesson is, where's the money going to come from?
It's interesting you say that. I read somewhere, and I don't know, I haven't had a chance to follow up on this, but of the money that was seized yesterday in the NCA raids, the £54 million, That gets split 50% to the police and 50% to the Treasury whenever it's finally gone through court and all the evidence is there and everything else. So it's a bit of funding coming back in. Now, your £25 million sounds like a lot of money, but to carry out a sort of investigation of the level that you're talking about, it's probably a drop in the ocean, especially when you're looking at having to do things in such an international way across borders and often into countries where it's very difficult to get in and work your way through, and you need to continuously maintain relationships in those places to even just get your foot across the door.
Well, I made the point earlier on that one of the reasons UWOs came in was to try to compensate for the fact that many of these investigations traditionally had to involve governments and law enforcement agencies from foreign governments, not all of whom were friendly, not all of whom had resources or skill sets. And that can't be underestimated as a problem even here, because the complexity of the explanation given in the Baker case by the respondents was such that in order to unravel it, you don't only need bodies within the NCA, you need highly accomplished and experienced and qualified technicians, if you like, to burrow through those multifarious channels of finance trails that are put up, and that costs a fortune. It's a big problem that they're going to have going forward.
It is, but there's a lot of, it's interesting, there's a lot of technology coming in the investigative side of things, and this is where the technological cracking of the EncroChat communications network has highlighted to serious and organised criminals the fact that the encryption that's out there that everyone is saying is essential, and the intelligence agencies are saying there's no need for that to be in civilian hands, isn't the be-all and end-all. Our intelligence agencies can get through it. They're just having to be smart in the way they do it. When it comes to financial investigation, with the growth of some of the financial investigation tools, and there's a company that I know produces the tools for most of the police forces across the UK, including the NCA, and they ingest all the financial data and look for patterns that human beings won't be able to see. And that company's called Altia ABM. Those patterns come together, but the next step of that is to bring in artificial intelligence that'll sit on it. So it'll crunch through and identify all of these patterns. And I've seen early day artificial intelligence used to crunch the movement of terrorist vehicles in different places. And it's amazing what it can pick up. And it's so difficult for people to hide. But it requires all that data to be available to be put into the system. And with Brexit and the issues that there are going to be with swapping data between the UK and the EU and the other data control regulations there are in different countries around the world, this is going to become probably increasingly difficult rather than increasingly easy.
I would have thought so, definitely. Yeah, I mean the advances in AI. I think the whole COVID-19 situation has no doubt led to an exponential rise in the development of AI. It's a whole new different topic, but one thing that concerns me is the advance of AI in China.
Yes.
Anti-democratic or undemocratic use of AI, as some refer to it as. That's a whole different subject. But it's ironic because so many criminal cases involve mobile phones. And this Encro thing is, of course, an all-singing, all-dancing version of your traditional burner phone.
Yeah.
That it sort of £2.50 Alcatel phone that you can go and buy an EED in the shopping precinct. You know. The number of times I've said to clients involved in organised crime, particularly drug trafficking cases, people trafficking, were, can't you people just learn to stay off the phones? Or if you do have to use the phone, don't use it for more than 2 or 3 days. Dump it. You know, I mean, there is a ready supply of these burners. You can get them online for nothing. And it's very ironic that the pure cleverness that was employed by these organized crime gangs by using Encro is the thing that's come back to bite them in the arse.
Well, again, people don't realize just what they're doing. You know, the criminals are going out there with their mobile phones. They've got their phone in their back pocket as they're going in. They commit the crime and they go away. And the first thing the police officer says when he comes around is, "Were you there? I wasn't anywhere near it, Gov. I was over there." Okay, well, why did your mobile phone ping in that mast? That is the closest mast to where you were there. Oh, I lost it. And you've instantly lost the position. And you know, it's not just your mobile phone, it's a number of other different things. You know, as cars get smarter, and people go down with their GPS system in their car, it'll be pinging. There is metadata sitting behind all of this that law enforcement agencies can pick up and will use.
Directly before I joined you for this podcast, I just came out of a remote hearing on a murder case I'm involved in, where the prosecution have they've dumped the cell site analysis, and we've just been served with a bulk of GPS stuff, which is way more accurate. This is a case that relies on very precise movements, timings, locations, but to the extent that cell site isn't quite accurate for the prosecution's needs. So they've dumped that. We've now got GPS. We'll see where that leads. But
it comes into the bit that you were talking about, China and AI, and everyone talks about, and it's not China, but it's South Korea. Everyone talks about the success of the test, track and trace in South Korea. The South Koreans are, again, I heard some of that, only about 20% of the South Koreans downloaded their tracing app.
Yes, I read that.
But what the South Korean government did was, instead of just relying on the app, they applied AI and looked at everything else that could be used to trace citizens that were there. So they used where they'd used their credit card details or their bank cards. They then linked that to facial recognition CCTV, and used AI to then monitor where people were going and then identify the other individuals that had come into close proximity and use them on the track and trace. Now, that was very much Big Brother looking down on you and applying every tool that they could get access to, and your mobile phone GPS data as well, in doing that. And the government has accessed it and did it. We can't do that in this country under our laws.
I watched a really fascinating webinar from the Royal United Services Institute a month or so ago on exactly this subject. And they were comparing what they were calling the undemocratic methods of track and trace, as propounded by China, with the more democratic systems being used in South Asia, Singapore, not sure if Malaysia was one of them, South Korea was definitely one, Hong Kong was another, I think. Mm-hmm. Fascinating stuff, highly successful in the main, mm-hmm. pretty frightening, because we all know where this is going to lead eventually. We've moved from terrorism and moving fags through Ireland to
But then it's the nation state. But there's a cultural piece to this. I did a podcast with a Chinese dentist, a British Chinese dentist. He's from Hastings, but he's running a company in Shanghai at the moment. And I was chatting to him about it, and he says, "Yes, everyone knows the government is watching everything that we do and monitoring our phones, monitoring everything else. But culture, we don't care." You know, we as a culture, we accept the fact that that's happening. And again, if you go through Southeast Asia, you know, the Singaporeans accept the fact that the Singapore government, and it's, you know, it's very open, very free place to live and all the rest of it, but the Singapore government have got their thumb on top of everything, and they know what's going on. Same as South Korea. So it's almost a Southeast Asian cultural thing that they don't mind the fact that they're being monitored, especially if they think it's for their wider collective good rather than anything else. Whereas if you try to impose that into the UK, we can't even get people to carry identity cards here.
No. But we are the most surveilled country. Are we not one of the most surveilled countries in the world? Or is London not the most surveilled capital in the world?
It is if you take the simplistic, this is the number of CCTV cameras that exist, this is against the population, therefore there's so many CCTV cameras per 1,000 population. However, what it doesn't take into account is that the majority of those CCTV cameras are sitting in the private sector, not the public sector. Even the ones that are in the public sector tend not to talk to each other, and there isn't one central big depository for all the CCTV imagery to come into, where you can do a sort of enemy of the state style tracking someone as they're running down the streets and going through. It most of these camera systems are you still have to physically go along with a USB stick and download the imagery and try and stitch it together and work out the angles and see if it'll pull something up. So we've got more CCTV cameras per head of population than many other countries, but they're just not joined together.
The thing that bothers me about China, I get what you say about the Singaporeans being under the cosh there in terms of surveillance, etc. What concerns me about China is it's their gradual, I call it their sort of soft imperialism, the way that they are exporting. It's not just their rubbish goods now, it's their technology, it's their know-how, yeah. It's their cyber ability, which is why, for the life of me, I don't understand what we're doing with Huawei and 5G and all of that. Again, it's probably more your field than mine, but my worry is that the capacity and the capability is there within China to exert an awful lot of control. And while the West has got its pants down, which it well and truly has right now, because there's no leadership in the US that anyone can give any credibility to, because we're all reeling financially and economically from this crisis. It seems, and we saw evidence of it last week, didn't we, with the crackdown in Hong Kong.
Yep.
They just see a big green light.
Oh, huge.
That concerns me.
It's fascinating. And I think this comes down to the way that they are politically structured. It was Xi Jinping in power for life. And now, interestingly, Vladimir Putin is in power to 2036. They can plan in multi-generational terms. Whereas we're having to plan in at most a parliamentary term, but usually it's the end of next week. What's the headline going to be then that our politicians are focused on? And your China is sitting back and it's expanding into the South China Seas and the Paracel and Spratly Islands. It's overflying Taiwan. It's building power projection military capability. It's suppressing the Uyghur population in China. It's increasingly surveilling its own population and controlling it. It's taking over most of the continent of Africa in a very successful way.
Well, I've seen that at first hand when I was in Sierra Leone. Yeah.
It's controlling a lot of areas that in the longer term are going to be areas of huge influence when it comes in. And you know, it'll have sat down with regard to Hong Kong, it'll have sat down and gone, right, what are the UK's priorities at the minute? UK's priorities are one, COVID-19, two, Brexit negotiations. Are they going to be bothered about Hong Kong? No. So now's the time to do it, because they'll jump up and down and shout, but nobody will do it. Huawei is another interesting one. And that's economic, and it's been stirred up, and I know Huawei fairly well. It's been stirred up quite badly by the US relationship and the trade war that's going on between the US and China. The Huawei kit is good value for money for what it does. The stuff that they're proposing to put into the 5G network isn't at the core of the 5G network. So, you know, if something happened to it technically, would that bring the network down? No. Would it compromise the data that we got going through it? Could the Chinese put something in there? Interestingly, no, because, and this goes back to, I think, 2009, when the Intelligence Security Committee in Parliament raised concerns about the amount of Huawei kit that there was through our 3G network. And BT owned that network. One of the recommendations that came out was to be able to have greater oversight of the Huawei kit and the Huawei source code. And Huawei recognized that they wanted to try and stay in the market. So they funded a research center called the Cell. That is staffed by UK security cleared personnel who are ex-GCHQ. And it's their sole job to take every bit of Huawei hardware apart, look at the software that's in it as well in the firmware, and look for backdoors that are put in there. And therefore, everything that comes into the UK network gets examined in minute detail by these people who have got UK security clearances. They're overseen by the National Cyber Security Centre, so by GCHQ, and can then report on the vulnerabilities that there are in the Huawei hardware. That is why the UK has been able to turn around and say that there's no great threat to the hardware. The biggest problem that there is with it is the engineering is very poor, because it's mass produced very cheaply, and a lot of the time when stuff's mass produced very cheaply, what they do is on the chips that are inside some of the equipment, they leave the development elements of it, the developer's back door open. Those are the ones where the engineers who are engineering it and reprogramming it can get in quickly, change the firmware, change a few lines of code here, and get out. Those are supposed to be closed down before it then goes into mass manufacturing. But in many cases, they cut out those steps because it's cheaper for them to do that. It's the same with every Chinese Internet of Things piece of equipment that's out there. So as people are sitting at home with their Amazon Dot or their Their smart TV that responds nicely when you shout at it. There's the same back doors are in there. So the Huawei case is really quite interesting, and it's been used in a trade war that Donald Trump.
But it sounds from what you're saying then that the rationale given by the British government as to why they are allowing Huawei in to develop 5G is one that you're satisfied by. You're not.
Yeah, I'm not overly concerned by it, because again, you know, since the 2009 report, BT have been removing Huawei from the core of the 3G network and replacing it.
Yeah, I saw that.
They've also recognised that, you know, the best way to mitigate against any particular threat, because, you know, if you buy some stuff from one of the other providers, well, the outside bit may have a label of a different company that's in there, but inside it, the chips may be manufactured in the same place that the Huawei chips are manufactured and everything else. So so where's the back door? Is the back door in the chip? Is the back door in the completed bit of hardware? Is it? I'm an Apple fan, and my iPhone and all the rest, it's made in China. The chips are made in China.
Yeah.
You know, so where do you stop? The British government has got a very good handle on what the threats are within it. And whenever Huawei staff turn up at the cell, they have to be escorted in. There's a central room in there where the source code is in, and they're allowed access into that, because that gives access to all of the raw source code that Huawei's got. There's a fantastic book on this, cybersecurity issues, by the BBC security correspondent Gordon Carrera, and it's called Intercept. Really, really, really good book.
I've read it. It's a great book. It's not as good as his current book, which is Russians Among Us, which is absolutely superb. Yeah. I've nearly finished that. Intercept is great, but he's very, very good, Gordon Carrera.
He is, and he's got a good writing style.
Yeah, it's getting better all the time. The current book is superb.
Yeah, no, I've read it. It's good. No, I think on our book recommendations, that's probably a good point for us to stop this one, because we've covered a lot, and there's an awful lot more that we can and I'm sure will cover in the future. Yeah. John, it's been a real pleasure talking to you on Chatting with Ingram today.
Yeah, lovely to see you, Philip.